You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Communicating Anthroposophy, The Course for Speakers to Promote the Idea of Threefolding, Collected Works, Volume 338, translated by Rory Bradley. This is Lecture 4, given in Stuttgart on February 14, 1921, in the afternoon. This is the first theme recommended for your speeches, the great questions of the present moment and the threefolding of the social organism. It is necessary for us to select these particular themes so that you have an opportunity to familiarize yourselves as precisely as possible with what is presently necessary, and also with what the impulse for threefolding the social organism has to offer in response to the great questions of the present. Furthermore, to allow for an opportunity to point out that anthroposophical spiritual science must provide the foundation for the kind of social thinking brought into the world by threefolding, and finally, so that the organizations like Der Kommende Tag, English The Coming Day, and others always have the opportunity to participate. Their work must extend into our movement as a whole, into spiritual as well as practical activities. On the one hand, they have the task of making the spiritual world into something plausible, because it is necessary now to cultivate a truly productive spiritual life. On the other hand, they have the task of reckoning with practical matters, because as a movement we must move into social life, into economic life, and to that end we simply have to become stronger financially, as much as possible, not for our own sake, but for the sake of the progress of economic life. Today I would like to present a few things relating to the themes prerequisite to our broader considerations. It would also perhaps be best if I name a second theme along these lines, the freedom of education and its development, and its relationship to the state and to economics. And then we will take up something like this as our third theme, the economic system of associations, and its relationship to the state and to free spiritual life. By taking up these three themes, we will then have the opportunity in the next 2 weeks of laying out before the world in an effective way everything that collectively belongs to our movement. Now, I shall begin by saying something fundamental about the first of these themes. It is important here that you show people that actually the demand for the three limbs of the threefold social organism already exists, that we are actually not suggesting anything other than putting what is already there into its proper form. Although in a different form, everything is there that should be there, and will be there, once it has been rearranged. A demand for three different things exists, but they are chaotically intermingled, and inwardly at odds as a result, like some kind of disastrous birthing in which the head ended up in the stomach and the digestive organs ended up in the heart, a birth in which the three systems of the organism have gotten all mixed up with one another. And so the proper form should simply be given to everything already present, everything that already wants to have an existence. In order to make this more apparent, let us begin with the third limb of the social organism, the economic life. This economic life, as it currently exists, can be accurately characterized simply by tracing its development through the last two centuries. It is only in the last two centuries that true economic life has taken on its current form, a form that has given rise to all the social questions. Of course, it has been a somewhat long and gradual process. Economic life, as it lies before us, even if we are to look back as far as we possibly can, that economic life still cannot be traced back any farther than sometime in the 13th or 14th century. During this period, we find that European economic life underwent a kind of crisis, a kind of subtle and creeping crisis, shall we say. It was during this period of time that the foundation of European economic life readied for a transformation. If we go back farther, into an even earlier period, we find that this European economic life was necessarily beholden to the continental exchange of business and goods between Asia and Western Europe via Central Europe. And we also find that in this prior period, economic life all over the world was carried out as a self-evident process. Even trade was practiced as something entirely self-evident. By and large, economic relationships were not yet so intensively developed as to necessitate that the freedom of exchange, the freedom of trade, be regulated or organized. But as the Central European population grew ever denser, as economic life grew ever more intensive, the need arose to organize everything. And from the more independent economic life of that prior period emerged an economic life that was much more bound up. The more independent economic life of an earlier time is characterized by the fact that individual economic activity was governed by independent sensibilities, with the farmhands, with the indentured populace, which was mostly limited to domestic economics according to the instincts of the landowners, and that more expansive trade, which was conducted with Asia, also did not require any particular regulation. It could be carried out freely, because back then economic life was not yet so intensive. But as I said, with the increase in population, as well as the development of other relations, which we can discuss in a moment, the intensity of economic life continually increased, and certain protective regulations had to be established that were not necessary before, regulations that were all intended, more or less, to somehow protect the consumer. This is somewhat peculiar, that in the period of time when economic life underwent a kind of gradual crisis, around the 13th and 14th centuries, there actually developed a tendency all over the world, though not by any general conscious effort, to establish measures that protected the consumer. What else is it except a protection of the consumer when the cities through which merchants traveled, through which the trade routes passed, instated the so-called storage laws, forcing the merchants passing through to stop for a certain number of days before being allowed to continue on and freely sell all of the goods that they were unable to sell in the city? This is about protecting the consumer. All over the world, the concern was for protecting the consumer. Though this may not be immediately apparent, there is something else from this period of time that must be reckoned against these efforts to protect the consumer. I have just been spending a good amount of time applying myself to this question, and recently found that the establishment and development of the guilds, though superficially concerned with organizing production, was also undertaken to support the consumption of the products made in those guilds. If you go to work on this problem without any preconceived notions, it is impossible not to find this. This happened by taking a detour through the process of organizing the means of production. Despite the fact that the guilds were formed through an incorporation of businesses that produced the same goods, this was not done initially with the intent of organizing the production of those goods. Rather, the merger was undertaken so that all of those businesses who were incorporated within the guild could sell their products at a price that protected the consumption of their goods, as I have suggested. The guilds were, in fact, a means by which the consumption of goods was protected. If you simply take a few books out of the library and compare the dates that you find there, then you will say to yourself, if you keep in mind the guidelines that I have given you here, This is what characterizes the economic life of that period of time. And now, this economic life has developed through several centuries under the influence of these various regulations. But it had always a kind of subtle and gradual crisis within its being. It has grown ever more intensive. And this is the peculiar thing. An economic life that grows ever more intensive in one particular territory creates a need for ever more limitations, regulations, and organization. An economic life that is somehow open, that has access on one side or another to inexhaustible resources, namely agriculture, the economics of the earth, does not have the same compulsion to organize itself. An economic life that is closed on all sides, one that becomes ever more intensive, feels the drive to organize in this way. Now, this European economic life would, as the centuries passed, have been driven toward a decadence of unimagined intensity if a certain event known to all of you had not occurred. What staved off this decadence was, on the one hand, the opening of the world seas, and on the other, the discovery of America. This opened up economic life again to the West. We cannot accurately say, can we, that this was akin to the opening of a release valve, because the opening that was created was simply too large. That would be a very big valve. But it is this event that steered economic life down an entirely different course. Now the opening of this path to the West also happened to coincide with the arrival of modern technology. But the expansion of this modern technology was made possible through an entirely different set of relationships than the ones that enabled the opening of economic life to the West. With simply these two things, the opening of the seas and the discovery of America, you have everything that gave to modern economic life its basic configuration. To that can then be added what I presented to you yesterday as the most significant political events of recent history. Within this European economic life, we then find two separate tendencies. The first tendency developed under the influence of the intensive economic life of the second half of the Middle Ages and beyond. And since then, it has taken on a particular manner of economic thinking. People learned how to think economically under the influence of the relationships that developed, let us say, from the 13th century through the 16th or 17th centuries. During that time, people began to take up the task of thinking about how one should practice economics. It was during that time that the now current economic ideas developed, first in trade, then more slowly in industry, and finally even in agriculture. These thoughts were all more or less established during that era. You could also say that all of the classes of the population that were and are called to practice economic thinking, primarily, at least at first, within the European territories, these people developed their economic thought life under the influence of the experiences from that time. This lies deep within each human being. It was because of this that the constitution of the human soul became conservative. All of the conservative thoughts that lie within the human being can at their core be traced back to this period of time. Economic life then opened toward the other side, as I have described to you. And because of this, something came into this whole imagination of economic life that was not immediately or unconditionally incorporated into that way of thinking. Instead, it gave that way of thinking a particular economic impulse. I mean by this the connection with the West, with America, with everything that came about through access to the seas. This made economic life powerful. And so, I would like to propose that the thought content of economic life and the driving impulse of economic life were thus formed. These circumstances were so potent that they gave current social life its entire configuration, including its materialistic form. And this modern civilization, took on more and more the character that necessarily resulted from these same two factors. So, now, we have an economic life that preponderates and dominates simply due to the force of historical events, one that has a profound impact on human beings and on human evolution. Economic life takes on the character that only it can, for it is naturally the case that each of the three limbs of the social organism takes on its own lawfulness according to its nature and being. In the economic life, commodities and prices are the guiding forces. This can, however, lead to a disruption of social relationships. If the economic life is intermingled with the two other limbs of the social organism, in that case, each limb simply follows its own laws in conflict with the others. And this is what has occurred. Because economic life predominates, it has drawn the other areas of life, other social limbs of life, into its system of lawfulness. And this leads to the appearance of other relationships that have subsequently led us to the great questions of modern society. If we look back into the history of our evolution, we see that the whole proletarian movement, in the form of a movement specifically demanding better pay, a movement against the enslavement of labor, simply did not exist historically. Yesterday I said to you that the division of labor, whether one was a lord or a serf, was established out of a rights political perspective in olden times. Now, economic life has arranged it so that everything takes on the character of a commodity. Everything became a commodity. And for the first time, human labor became a commodity. Prior to that, it was service, voluntary or compulsory service. But only in this modern period did it become an actual commodity. And economic life can do nothing other than turn everything that falls under its purview into a commodity. And in this sense, I think we have actually always had a threefolded society. We must only actualize it. We must only take what exists in a false form and establish it in the world in its true form. In the false form, it does us harm. It will lead to our downfall. If we are in the position to give it a true form, then it will lead us forward. But it is not only the labor force that was turned into a commodity. The materialistic spiritual life was also turned into a commodity in the form of capital. At some time, please take a look at the capital market, at the accumulation and use of capital in modern times, and compare it with the treatment of capital in, say, ancient Greece. In ancient Greece, the man who had the power to make something happen was the one who held political power. He had the power to build this or that. On a political basis, he was able to find those who would carry out the task, and his capital was based on the fact that through his earthly relationships, he was the ruler and could give orders to a large number of people. That was what capital looked like in ancient Greece. In modern times, which we are now considering, everything that results in any sort of undertaking has also been fundamentally transformed into a commodity. What else are you doing when you buy or sell products on the market? What exactly are you dealing in? At the core, you are dealing in the spirit of an enterprise. Everything that we can call the spirit of enterprise has been essentially transformed into a commodity. You do not have the specifics, the particulars of an undertaking before you. You have no idea what you are buying or selling, but in reality you are buying or selling the spirit of an enterprise. You can observe this yourself in the redistributions of the capital market. To put it briefly, wherever the economic life predominates, everything is invested with the character of a commodity. Everything becomes commodity. The labor force becomes a commodity. Spirit itself becomes a commodity. This has been the course of recent evolution. Now, something entirely different is happening at the same time. The modern state has been formed on a political basis. We see at first, do we not, that these modern states form out of certain pre-existing free relationships between the surrounding rural populations and the existing cities, which formed around church epicenters in Italy and with a somewhat different mindset in France and England. And so the things we call states are formed from these conditions. Whereas in the West, this concept of the state is already taking form, in Central and Eastern Europe we continue to see something else, namely relationships that are still somewhat freer. As a result of the older relationships, we see that the existing cities, which formed around churches or something similar, become market epicenters. And as these old cities gradually turn into markets, new cities are simultaneously forming. It is interesting to see how these cities came to be in the 11th, 12th, and 13th centuries under the influence of economic life. First in present-day southern Germany and in western Europe, they started to form about 5 or 6 hours' journey from one another. In northern and eastern Europe, they form about 7 or 8 hours apart. In older times, this made perfect sense. Why? Because the farmers who did their business in the area needed to get to and from the city with their products in one day. This came about as a result of an inner necessity. But when something like this happens in history, then something else not motivated by the same inner necessity comes about simply because of the principle of imitation. First, there comes the need to have cities that lie about 5 or 6 hours from one another, or perhaps even 7 or 8 hours. And then, afterward, people look at that and say, now there's a good idea, and they imitate it. This brings about things not motivated by necessity. It compromises some people's ability to think about these things healthily. The historians treat one city as though it were just like any other, meaning they treat those that arose out of economic necessity in the same manner as those that did not arise out of economic necessity. Everything then starts to get confusing and messy. You must have a feeling for the difference in order to look at this properly. People might be able to argue very convincingly that this city or that city did in fact come about due to economic necessity. But to be sure, this is not always true. Some cities did not come about due to economic necessity, but rather because of the principle of imitation. The general rule is correct, regardless. This circumstance, that cities formed as marketplaces, was the case for much longer in Eastern Europe than in the West, where centralized states developed and then sought to incorporate everything into their established frames. Historically considered, it may seem fundamentally uncomfortable to claim that the territorial regions, as well as a certain federal system, developed out of the spirit of the patriarchal togetherness felt by rural and city populations in Italy, whereas a different system developed in France, Spain, and England. And whether or not it is uncomfortable, as I have suggested, for you to think in this way, it is nevertheless true that as you move toward Central and Eastern Europe, the formation of the countries, as was true of the cities earlier, occurred more through imitation than anything else. And here we arrive at something that you cannot say to people yet, because it would result in fourfolding rather than helping toward threefolding. But it is the truth regardless. The fact that the Western countries developed into unified states was, of course, an economic necessity, but it was also something that emerged from the dispositions of the various peoples living there. But the Central and Eastern European countries actually developed only because of imitation. For them, there was no historical necessity. The German and Austrian empires finally fell because their inner organization was based on imitation. There was no historical necessity for them. And North America, which is entirely dependent upon incorporating into economic associations, is yet another outward imitation that has not even arrived inwardly at what the Central European countries have achieved. Anyone who takes a proper look at the economic relationships of North America will be able to definitively predict the course of events there. Now you see, beside everything that developed primarily from the original system of economics, the modern configuration of trade arose under the influence of the kinds of relationships that I have described to you. And this was where the fusion of political life and economic life occurred, not in industry, but in trade. Industry was only just getting underway. It is cheap and easy to argue against what I am saying now. One need only protest, quote, "But industry had to be there first, because only then could people start trading things," close quote. This is not the point. Even if you consider some of the most developed industries now, most of these have not yet grown beyond the commercial sector. People simply create their own products for the trade that they engage in. We have not yet gone so far as to find the bridge that will carry us from original production, based in nature, through trade, which prefigures business, to what currently predominates. For in the moment that business becomes predominant, associations become a necessity. The structure of present-day commercial trade is still determined by the principles of trade. Even industry comes from the principle of trade. In essence, industrialists are tradesmen, different only in that they produce the goods they trade. Even in their industrial establishments, their perspective is always directed toward simple commerce. These are the predominant principles. In the moment that business takes hold in simple commerce, associations become a necessity. The fusion of the state and economic life has actually occurred via a detour through commerce. And on the other hand, each of the three limbs of the threefold social organism has its own laws and fights against the others if they are not properly detached from one another. As you can see, the right's political life has been fighting with the economic life for some time now, over matters like economic regulations, pension funds, and so on. What else can this mean except that people are trying foolishly to separate labor from economic life? It would be a clever thing if anyone were actually able to detach it fully. But in an attempt to do just that, the states are, quote, on the march, close quote, if I can be permitted to use a phrase that, as you know, was misused by Wissel. On the march for an independent rights life. By creating things like workers' protection laws or laws regulating pension funds, they take the organization and regulation of labor and the working day away from economic life. Now, we see here that the second limb of the threefold social organism is on the road to emancipation from economic life. The matter of spiritual life is a bit more confusing. All true spiritual life is, at its core, an outgrowth of the ancient theocracies. You need only to study university life in the 12th and 13th centuries to see this. This university life developed entirely out of the church, and it was an emancipated spiritual life. Only gradually did it grow together with political life. A large part of the European wars consisted of nothing more than the movement of religious institutions into the political realm. And regarding these ancient times, you must say to yourself, quote, "The freedom of educational institutions was much greater under the old church system than it was and is under later political systems," close quote. For these institutions are developed and with full consciousness out of the spiritual life. For example, it was with full consciousness that at the Ecumenical Council in Constantinople in 869, the church disestablished the spirit. That is, they elevated to the level of dogma the assertion that the human being does not consist of body, soul, and spirit, but rather only of body and soul, and that the soul has certain spiritual qualities. At the time, this was done with full awareness. now philosophy professors, preach that the human being comprises body and soul, without knowing that they are only proselytizing a bit of church dogma. What we call philosophy has developed out of older church life, and so, consequently, Herr Wundt in Leipzig is merely a scion of old church dogma, even though this might no longer be apparent in his manner of presentation. But the same is true of other things that developed out of the older theocratic mode of spiritual life. The theology departments, well, just take a look. They have really grown apart from earlier spiritual life, so that they really present only a caricature of that former state of being. The same with the law departments. Anyone who looks around will find the shell of older theocratic existence in modern civilization. I do not even want to talk about medicine. It is blatantly obvious that it has grown out of other connections with the older spiritual life that developed in churchly religious ways. We have there a stream, a branch of spiritual life, that grew entirely in relationship to a church life free from state influence, which was precisely the one true spiritual life in a previous era. This brings us to something I would like to suggest that develops not out of spiritual life, but parallel to it, modern natural science and technology. There, spiritual life has grown in its own ground and merely taken on some resemblance to what previously developed out of the church. This is why everything that developed fitfully, if I may put it so, in imitation of older constructs, appears so strange. Through imitation, people built more and more vocational high schools, commercial schools, economic schools, and so on. All of that haltingly took on similar forms to everything that had developed out of earlier church life. And this is why the structure of higher education is so unnatural, something that in many ways has a kind of braid-like, pleated quality. The actual essence of the university instead displays its antique churchly inheritance. And then we have those schools that are actually somewhat humorous when you place them beside their precedents, that is, the modern economic schools, the vocational schools, the mining colleges, and so on, all of which have sought some similarity with the universities, even in superficial things like their names. So on the one hand, we have the spiritual life and how it turned from an older free church life into one that was slowly absorbed by the state. And on the other hand, we have the intrusion, shall we say, once again originating in a certain state of freedom. For spirit must indeed be free. Genius cannot be manufactured by the state. The intrusion of spiritual life finding a new place for itself in political life. It would have been consistent with the ideals of many people to cultivate true artists at art schools. But you know already that the educational program that cultivates the genius or the true artist does not yet exist, despite the fact that people want it. And thus we see how the spiritual life is absorbed altogether inadequately. Basically, only the exterior form of it is taken in. The content is constantly forced to be, shall we say, restrained or to be completely curtailed. For is it not true that if you find yourself in the position of having a bit of spirit, which is a wholly unpleasant position to be in now, then you have to protect it, at the very least keep it secret throughout all of the terrible torment of exams and other things, so that it does not freeze and harden inside of you, so that you can let it unfurl afterward. Indeed, you have to keep everything belonging to true spiritual life hidden under your hat. This is how it is. And this, at its core, is nothing other than a kind of emancipation of that spiritual life, a latent form of self-emancipation. We stand here before a brewing crisis. The final consequence of socialism is no less than Marxism, Bolshevism in its radical form. Everything becomes, in quotes, socialized. The whole state becomes one big industrial establishment, a giant business venture. At least that is their ideal. Now, if people undertake to see this through, then it becomes necessary to organize all of the technical knowledge that is part of this whole menagerie. Machinery is, of course, what I meant to say. Without this technical knowledge, you cannot move forward. Modern technology is absolutely necessary. But Bolshevists and all of the other groups that want to bring Marxism to bear upon reality can bring about nothing other than its ruthless exploitation. By this I mean that you can enslave technically gifted people for a period of time, but they will slowly fade, disappear if not first allowed to cross over into an independent, emancipated, free, productive, spiritual life. The whole world is standing before precisely this crisis in every region where the socialization, in quotes, of spiritual life is taking radical strides forward. Just as the other two limbs of the social organism, rights political life and economic life, have their own governing laws, the way in which economic life makes everything a commodity, the way in which rights political life encloses everything economic, even what does not fit within its purview, so too must spiritual life, according to its own laws, emancipate itself from the two others. So there is a demand for these three limbs of the social organism, the spiritual limb, the rights political limb, and the economic limb. For this reason, these comprise the three great questions of the present. The three great questions of the present are the question of the proper form for spiritual life, of the proper form for rights political life, and of the proper form for economic life. And we encounter this everywhere, that other attempts at answers are being made. Simply take a look at, for example, what is coming out of the various denominations in Central Europe and Germany, where people in the evangelical unity movements and in the young Catholic movements, among others, are trying to galvanize the older generation, to squeeze something that still has life out of that older generation in the hope of having some sort of spiritual life, because they do not have the courage for a truly productive spiritual life. You see, everywhere these clumsy attempts at bringing to birth a new spiritual life. Naturally, the attempt to squeeze something more out of an old lemon cannot really lead to any true spiritual formation. The only thing that can lead to that is a turn toward a productive spiritual life. But we are seeing these sorts of clumsy attempts being made everywhere. We are seeing how the Americans are turning out for a renewal of Christianity because they believe that humanity cannot recover on the basis of old state principles. But nowhere will you find those with the insight to see that producing a new spiritual life must come out of its own original sources. Everywhere people are cobbling together the things that are already there. This proves that people are already instinctively on the right path, but that they have not yet found the courage to establish a truly independent spiritual life in a pure form. On the other hand, we are seeing how the old state principles that have developed in Europe since the 15th and 16th centuries are dying in their sleep. What else would you call the monstrosities that people call peace treaties and the like, that have occurred since Brest-Litovsk and Versailles? What else would you call that but a snoring, suffocating state principle, one that cannot give form to anything except terrible things, one that creates structures that have no chance at existence? Czechoslovakia, for example, will have no chance at existence because it does not have the things it needs. The Polish state is to be restructured once again. It is simply not possible for the political life to recover when it is built upon the democratic principle of, quote, all men are equal, close quote. In other words, when it encompasses all of the concerns of each and every adult. For as long as contemporary life is so chaotically intermingled, we will not get anywhere. Here we see that in fact the political life is dying in its sleep on one side, while trying to prove, on the other, that it absolutely must take worker regulations under its purview. And so we can say that we have the spiritual question, demonstrated by the fact that clumsy attempts at moving forward are being made, for example, in the evangelical unity movements and the young Catholic movements. We have the rights political question, demonstrated, for example, in the peace treaties. And we have economic life, standing before us as the third great question of the present, out of which, at its core, the great war against the West really arose, and which readily invites itself into groups discussing revolutionary impulses and other similar things. This matter must therefore be addressed from all sides of the problem. You will find among the lectures that I have given here one that addresses these things directly. Now, from the perspective of these three great present-day questions, we must address our first theme. We must embrace the idea that these great questions are out there, the spiritual question, the rights political question, and the economic question. And therefore the threefold social organism is not something that has been invented, but rather something that has been read and derived from these three great questions of the era. And on the other hand, we must also embrace the fact that everything that has been prepared through anthroposophical spiritual science is a foundation for a truly productive spiritual life. All spiritual life from earlier periods found in the religious denominations, of which the branches of the present-day university are simply descendants, this old spiritual life has outlived its time. The other, new spiritual life, meaning the one that has grown out of natural science and technology, has not yet been able to begin its life. It has not been able to spiritualize itself. It must be driven toward spiritualization by the same kind of thinking that led to the development of the older spiritual life. Spiritual science will eventually become as productive as earlier spiritual life, which is now in a state of decadence in the religious denominations. This is what gives spiritual life its content, its purpose. And when you can see into the matter thus, you will properly recognize that the question, quote, "Where is free spiritual life supposed to come from?" close quote, can be answered in full confidence by saying, quote, "We have to speak not only of the demands of free spiritual life, but also of something that can be placed within the framework of this free spiritual life, something that produces spirit, something that is, in fact, living spirit." Close quote. You will then be able to point to the anthroposophical sources related to this. In that moment, you can develop something that, if you want to bring it to the public at large, must be brought forward with a certain enthusiasm, so that our interior lives turn outward, so that really everything that you are as a person, everything that has brought you together, enters into the public. This must be the only tone that you strike in your lectures. You must be clear about this, that anthroposophy gives to free spiritual life its content and its sustenance. On the other hand, you will find a different tone when you deeply feel that economic life turns everything into a commodity, and that everything that should not be made into a commodity must be removed from economic life. Then you will find the dry tone of sober consideration that must run through your lectures when you speak about economic life. In those moments, you can speak soberly and dryly. You must speak in that manner, as though you were doing computations. And this is how you will find the two different nuances that you need for your lectures. And you will find them to be entirely different from one another. The dry, sober tone of the dry economic analyst, and the enthusiastic tone of someone who is speaking of free spiritual life, not merely as a political ideal, but rather speaks as though knowing what wants to enter in. And then you will find, between these two rhythmically alternating tones, no need to have any convulsive rants or anything like that, the third tone, the tone that you will need for handling the rights political realm. But it is necessary that in your voice itself you become intensively threefolded, so that you recognize this properly, that in your soul you have a different bearing toward spiritual life, a different bearing toward rights political life, a different bearing toward economic life. When speaking about spiritual life, you speak with inner strength and conviction. You speak as with the true knowledge that every human being is an authorized participant in the harmonious spiritual life of humanity, in the harmony of human spiritual life. When speaking about the rights political life, you speak in a way that allows the soul to swing like a pendulum from one side to the other. Duties, rights, rights, duties. You speak with a certain cool deliberation, which need not have any resemblance to the pretentious mendacity of old statesmen, but it does come with a certain deliberation, insofar as in the rights political life, justice befalls one person just as it does another. And when speaking about economic life, you speak as though you did not have merely your own purse to look after. It may seem to be nonsensical, but you should speak with the feeling that you have other people's purses in your bag and are responsible for tending to all of them. You should speak with this feeling because you must go about your work as carefully as possible, because unexpected things that you had not thought of can sometimes happen. The secure feeling that you have in relation to spiritual life, in spiritual life, so long as you have grasped it properly, nothing can go wrong. You cannot have this same secure feeling regarding economic life. It is very possible for things to go wrong there. This must be present in the tone that you use to speak about these matters. This is why you will find that in Toward Social Renewal, spiritual life is spoken about with absolute certainty and definiteness. When it comes to economic affairs, only certain examples are used, so that the reader has the feeling that it could always be different. This is what will give your speech a certain inner strength, being intensively threefolded in your inner life. And what I am recommending to you is meant to lead you a little bit toward this inner state of being. Since most of you are young, if you become aware of this threefolding of the human orator, this will be a source of strength for your work. The end of Lecture 4.